Hello and welcome back to Project Pod with me, Marietta Sandylands. Today in episode 17, I was speaking with Jeannie Gordon of the Ministry of Parenting. So the Ministry of Parenting is a community interest company that Jeannie has been running for 10 years. And they run parenting programs and also training programs for professionals in Essex. So today we talk about why they do what they do at the ministry and why Jeannie started the business. We talk about things like what makes a group work well. So we have a discussion about things like the importance of diversity and having a range of people and range of opinions in a group. And also, I love what Jeannie said about having people who will question you in the group as a reflection of their engagement and wanting to working out what is useful and relevant for them. We talk about the importance of running evidence-based programs. So knowing that you're giving value to people because the groups that they run have been proven to work before. And I asked Jeannie how she sees her role in the groups, and she talks about the importance of being a facilitator and working collaboratively with parents to help bring ideas out of them. So it's an interesting time for the business. Jeannie was telling me how traditionally that over the last 10 years, the ministry has been sustained by large grants. These have unfortunately been cut, and they're now at a point of deciding what they're going to do with the business. So we talk about really where they're at, taking stock, looking at other options. So I hope you enjoy the conversation today. And here is the conversation with Jeannie.
Okay, so today I'm here with Jeannie Gordon, who is the founder of the Ministry of Parenting. Thank you so much for your time today, Jeannie, agreeing to come be interviewed on Project Pod. So I was wondering if you could tell people a little bit about what the Ministry of Parenting, what exactly you do as an organisation.
Okay, the Ministry of Parenting, we sort of have two arms really. Half the arm is we work with parents, and that is in, we offer different type of parenting programmes. And they tend to be evidence-based parenting programs. So we'll go and we actually deliver them every single week in Essex. And then to support that and to support the development more locally and widespread of parenting, we offer parent training as well. So that's the two arms of what we're actually doing in the Ministry of Parenting. But we're a very small organisation.
How many of you are there in the organisation?
There's four permanent staff. And there are a group of independent co-facilitators and trainers that we bring in when we need. It's just a lot, I think with the name, a lot of people have this sort of feeling that we are a big government organisation.
Yeah.
We had a patron, a lovely lady that also worked for Parenting UK. She's retired now. And I remember her being asked to present in Russia, and she was introduced as the Minister for England for the parenting. And she had a sort of like, you know, she'd have the heart to tell them, I don't think, actually. No, it's only ours in Essex. Nice organisation, but that's who we are. Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. And I'm interested in why you started it, because I discovered you through when I was working in as an assistant psychologist, and you gave us a brilliant training in the Incredible Years Parenting Group. And I know your background, you were a mental health nurse, that was how you kind of got into this whole world. But what was that transition like? And why did you start your own business?
Yeah, I think it was 10 years ago this year. And I was very well supported for a long time in the Mental Health Trust. My manager and the people around me were absolutely fantastic. But I think it sort of coincided with the children's centre, Sure Start schemes all starting. And I think as an organisation, the trust had to look at their own books, and they were feeling that the preventative side of the work that we were doing had to be pulled back. Because at the point, what we were doing then is I was doing preventative parenting groups for parents of children that didn't have diagnosis. And then we had parenting groups for children who we called our treatment program, who did have diagnosis. So we were doing a mixture of both, and they wanted to stop the prevention. We really didn't want to do that. And at the same time, I had just qualified as a mentor, which is like a trainer, in the Incredible Years baby program. And I just qualified that week in it, and it took me so long to get there. And that meant I wouldn't be able to do that program. So I sort of threw my sort of teddy out of the cot, really. And I sort of said, well, if you can't support me doing this, I'm going to have to find another way. I didn't really mean it, really, I don't think. But I went away on holiday, and over those 2 weeks, I was thinking, actually, the NHS have trained me so well in these programs, and they work. I can't just not do them anymore. So I went to the local, we've got a local organisation here in Colchester that's sort of like run by the council that gives you little courses on businesses. So I did a 3-day business course just for me to think about what was out there. And I didn't want to be a charity. And the reason for that was if I was going to give up my salary, my nurse pension and all the rest of it, I wanted a feeling of control. And I felt if I had a charity, the board of trustees would, the people that I would want as a board of trustees would be conflict of interest. So I was trying to think, well, who could be a board for me that I could trust my sort of future wages with? So I was contemplating that when they were really new, these community interest companies. And it seemed to me like a really nice way of forming a business, but still having it non-for-profit. So it still had all the values that I believed in. But I could also have some control. So that's really where that started. A huge amount of naivety. If I'd known what it entailed, there's just no way you would have done it. I would have done it. Total naivety. A huge amount of support from family. My husband was absolutely unbelievable. I was lucky to be in a position when I could go without wages for a period of time, etc. My boss and everybody around me, all the other nursing teams, were absolutely amazing in contributing everything from envelopes to sticky notes. I had all my nursing colleagues just empty their handbags, and then I had stationery for a year, just in pens and stuff. My brother-in-law's company were getting rid of all their computers, so they gave me their old computers. Another company gave me their old desks. And it sort of just sort of started like that, really. And another colleague of mine who had been working in the charity organisation doing a similar thing joined us, and she was the co-director, and we started the ministry. We got our name because it was really difficult to find a name. We knew what we wanted to do, but what we were going to call ourselves, because all the good names have gone. And at the time, it was a psychologist colleague of mine. I'd just bought Jamie Oliver's new book, The Ministry of Food. Mm-hmm. And in that book, you have recipes from World War II, really, where when there was rationing and women passed on good, healthy recipes. And she just said to us, you know, isn't this what you're trying to do, but pass on good, healthy parenting? So that's where the Ministry of Parenting sort of name came from. Mm-hmm. And that's how I started. Very, very small.
Yeah, and with very much a sort of group effort, it sounds like, as well, with support from people all around you. And I'm interested in what the difference is between a community interest company and a charity exactly. What is the difference there?
Yeah, I mean, the difference being when you have a community interest company, you only need a minimum of 2 directors. You are regulated as a company, not a charity. So you have to submit accounts to Company House, etc. But your profit, so it's called non-for-profit, but that's not really correct because actually they want you to make profit. The profits go back into the actual company for the community good. You don't get the same tax benefits all the time as a charity. We're very lucky in Colchester, we do get business rates reductions. Mm-hmm. But you're not always taxed as some of the tax issues are a bit different. It's not as well recognised, so people don't know what a community interest company is. So it does affect things like donations. because people know what a charity is if they're donating to. Also, some of the charities that give money to other charities aren't able to give to us because we don't have a charitable number. We have a community, we have a company number, not charitable number.
Okay.
But the advantage is, as a director running the community interest company, I have a lot more freedom. I can sign off checks, accounts, etc. I don't have to put it through a board. Now, we have opted to have, we've got an advisory board that we put in, a parents advisory board and a professional one. One to help with the business, the professional and direction. And we have a parents board that meet once or twice a year, and they just help us keep us grounded and keeping, making sure that we're keeping to our mission statement and the voice of the parents is what we do. Mm-hmm. But they're voluntary things. They're not expected. You don't have to have them in as a community interest company.
Okay. I was also thinking about, in terms of obviously parenting groups, that's what you do.
Yeah.
What is it that you think makes a good group? Because for me, it was, I was really, I think, as I was saying to you before we were recording it, really it was that experience when you gave us the training, bringing us inside the group and that experience of the parents there. What is it that makes a group work well, do you think?
I wish I could just put that as a formula. It really would make a fortune. It's really interesting because sometimes you get groups that, on paper, if you look at the information that you've got of these families, you think, oh, this looks like going to be a difficult group or a hard group, or this isn't going to work. And then they walk in and it's just, they just gel. So part luck of just the parents that come in. And I'm always amazed. I find that my groups can be quite diverse, and sometimes it's the diversity that just make it work. And people get on with each other that you wouldn't think would. It's just quite, you know, when you watch these people form their relationships, because they come with the one thing in common, and that is they want things to be better for their children. And because they come with that, and that's their common belief with all of them, they just work really well together and support each other. I mean, we do get some quirky personalities, but you do in all groups.
Yeah.
But that makes it really. Yeah. I like a group when the group are a little bit challenging. I like it when they question. I don't like yes groups, because I think if they're questioning what you're doing and what you're saying or discussing, they're thinking about it, they're trying to think about how it will work in their family, with their family values. So I like that sort of group.
Do you have any particular memories of, I'm trying to think of particular groups or of challenging situations that you've got through in a group, or people perhaps who've come and perhaps not been that keen on the idea of attending a parenting group, but how you've really shown them and the value of the work, really? So
lots, really. I often tell the story of the hairy man. And this was in a group we did, and we had this gentleman come, and all the parents, it was an introduction, and all the parents were there waiting, and then this really tall guy, not fat, he was just really broad and big, and he had really long hair, big long beard, hairy arms, he was in leathers, he was very intimidating, but also the hairiest man I've ever seen. And he sort of stomped into the room and grabbed the chair and turned it around and sort of like heavily plonked himself down, so his back was to everybody else, and the whole room just went silent. And at that moment, just being really aware of just how uncomfortable this man must be in this group environment. So I sort of guess he might be a rolly man. So we just, if in doubt in any group, you just have a cup of tea. So we just called out, we just said we'd have an extra cup of tea before we got started. And we went outside, he had a rolly, and I just started building a relationship up with him. And I think it was about his expectations when he came into this group. He told me ages later he expected me to be sitting there with a guitar singing Kumbaya. But what was quite fascinating was he completed the whole group program with the evaluations. And on the last session, he came in and he was no longer a hairy man. his hair had all been cut back, the beard had all gone, and it was like he could be seen. So we were, and he brought a camera, he wanted a picture of the whole group. So when he left, we were feeling, me and my co-facilitator, quite chuffed with ourselves. You know, we were sitting there and like, you know, look at us, we've got this difficult gentleman and he's in the group, he came every week, and look at his self-esteem, all that. But when we looked at the evaluation about the relationship between him and this was a teenager, when we looked at that, there was very little change. And I was quite disappointed with the lack of change. So I went to go and see them to find out why. And actually, this family went on to be really successful in family therapy. And what this dad said to me was, what the group taught him was how to be in a group, how to communicate, how to feel safe in that environment. And that allowed him to then go on and accept other types of therapeutic work. So for me, I think it was a real reminder that that when parents come under group, it was their first experience. It's really important that they feel accepted and feel a sense of belonging, because you don't know where that will put them on their journey for future help. Yeah. So we try very hard to make parents feel really accepted. So we spend a lot of time, we make sure with hardly any budget, but we try to make sure that they feel comfortable. You know, we're mindful of our drinks, our refreshments. Had a dad in my group today. I always text the parents during the week, and I text them, and he texts, I said, you know, my text was looking forward to see on Thursday, and he went, yeah, I'll be there, you know, it's the day before my birthday. So he had hinted it was his birthday. So and he loved Jammy Dodgers. Okay, every week we have to have Jammy Dodgers out for him. So we got him a birthday cake, but we covered it in Jammy Dodgers. And so he came in today, everyone said happy birthday. But actually, it's about him feeling, we've noticed you, we sort of, it is about caring, but it's a little bit about parenting the parents so that then they can go and parent their children. Mm-hmm. So I think that's very much core.
Yeah.
One of our values, we've got it written up on one of our walls, and that is, people don't remember what you say. They often don't remember what you look like, but they'll always remember how you make them feel. And I think if a parent comes to us and feels belonging, feels nurtured, I think then they're open for learning, and then hopefully they'll be able to go home and sort of do that to their own children.
Yeah, I think that's a great story to hear that and understand. It's about, you're not kind of dragging someone across the line, it's about meeting someone where they're at and sowing seeds to help, like you say, for future therapeutic work, and realizing that this is a process that takes time. So
and also, we're very lucky, we do have parents that are forced to come, I suppose, through either, you know, the court has ordered through social care, or the court been ordered if there's been a separation and they want access to the child. So sometimes they come, but they're not forced to come every week. So the parents who come every week are the ones who want the positive change. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, they may resist some of the strategies, they may resist some of the content that we deliver. They may not always agree with that, but they always want to make things better for their children. So they're not resilient. They're not resistant to us, if you know what I mean. So I've got a very good job. It's lovely.
And I know, so you teach, in terms of the groups that you run, you said that they're evidence-based programs. So why is that important?
It depends on your ethos of where you would put evidence-based. So predominantly, our main programs are based on the Incredible Years. Mm-hmm. They're evidence-based in the fact that they've got evidence to prove they are effective. Now, a lot of measurements for evidence-based practice is based on control trials. Mm-hmm. The Incredible Years has got international control trials, so we know it's got the evidence, so we can say we know and proven by control trials that this is a good program that will have good outcomes. Other programs will call themselves evidence-based because they're based on evidence of theory that has good outcomes. So we use the Incredible Years. We also have a program called STOP, which is our teenage parenting program. Mm-hmm. And we have a program called FLASH, which stands for Families Learning About Self-Harm. Mm-hmm. Now, these two programs have not had control trials. but they're based on good evidence, therapeutic evidence, and we have evidence from our evaluations. We evaluate every single program that we actually do before and after. So that's where we would have our evidence, but they don't have controlled trials, only the incredible years.
Okay.
We would love a controlled trial on the others, we just can't afford them. Horrendously expensive.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I remember something from that I remember from doing your training was about how you bring the materials alive, because I remember some of the videos from the that are used as the in the Incredible Years vignettes. You use these videos as a talking point, really, to discuss different attitudes to parenting, different ways of parenting, and that always stuck with me. You know, not denigrating the materials that you have, but really using them to the most positive effect possible. I just wondered if you could say something a bit about that.
Yeah, especially in the Incredible Years, they use videotape. So we show bit clips. And some of the clips are old, some of them are 30 years old, some of them are newer. And what you're trying to do is not get a parent, not showing a parent this is what you're supposed to do. The idea is they just promote discussion. And actually, you don't want your parents to like all the videos. You're hoping that they're going to disagree with some elements of it. And I think it's a really, I like visuals anyway. I think it helps my learning style. I think it helps a lot of other people's learning style. So you've got this visual sort of a situation of a child and a parent doing something. And then you would encourage the group to discuss it, debate it. But what you're getting the parents to do is think about, you know, they might say, well, my child wouldn't do that. So what would your child do? How would you respond? So you're getting them to really unpick. Because I think it's a really the collaborative process that you're trying to get. And this is all linked with the parents sharing their ideas. Because the parents have a huge amount of knowledge. They've tried lots of different things and they can give each other so many top tips. And it's often, it's just having that forum, isn't it? Just sit back and discuss it and brainstorm it as a so I love the tools of the videoing. And then we get the parents to practice. We never call it role play. It would never come back if we use that word. So we do what we call skills practice. So we get them to practice different situations and then, again, stop, think about how would you do that with your particular young person. So I think we use all different mediums to help with people's learning styles.
Yeah, I think it's a really, which I remember from learning about the Incredible Years and seeing it as a really nice way to have an indirect kind of entry point into discussing these issues rather than feeling like your parenting is under the microscope and, you know, as you said, there's a right or wrong way. And because there were very, very different approaches. I remember things like someone who, the idea of whether, I think there was a vignette around a father who had quite kind of very firm rules and whether this was the, you know, actually it wasn't about sort of saying that he was right or wrong, but going this idea of making your expectations clear as a parent. So things like really interesting discussions that will come out like that.
It's getting parents thinking about actually what are my values, what are my morals with parenting, what is it I believe in. We're not telling them what they have to do. Our job is we give the best evidence-based research in managing, and I think a lot of it is that, you know, I say to the parents, you're doing a lot of this already. It's just going back to basics. And I mean, you know, just getting parents to spend more time with their children. We all have got really, really busy lives. Social media has had so many advantages, but so many disadvantages. And it's trying to encourage the parents just to spend more time. And parents who start building in that more time, you can see the difference.
Yeah.
And they the results. I mean, some of our families are working really hard. They've got children with very difficult disabilities or temperaments, and they're worn out. But at the same time, it's just we've got to motivate them. We've got to give them lots of rationales and lots of encouragement just to keep going, really.
Yeah, that makes me think. What do you see your role then as Jeannie in terms of running the groups? Because how do you, when you're doing your best work, what do you think, what is your role really in that group?
It's like, I like to think that I facilitate more than teach, but I mean, it doesn't always work that way. It depends on the group. Some groups you tend to be a little bit more directive than others. But I think for me, the whole idea is I've got in my head these key concepts, these key principles that I want these parents to go away with. But if I just stand there and just tell it to them, they're not going to take it on. So I think I get really excited when you're doing a group and the parents, you facilitated it in a way that the parents are coming out with the ideas and they're owning that. And then at the end of the group, when you get comments like, you know, they really like the group support, the group discussion, then you know that you've been collaborative in your style.
Yeah.
So I get really excited when, you know, they get those light bulb moments and you can just see it. And there's also something very visual which happens in the parent group. And I'd love to take photographs of the parents where they come in and come out, come in at the very beginning and then out at the very end. Because you see a physical difference. It's very subtle, but you can see a difference in their self-esteem and just feeling they've got a little bit more control.
Yeah. I was wondering, what would you say that you have learnt, the major things that you've learnt, because it's been 10 years since you started the Ministry of Parenting, and I know you've got different things planned for next year, but what are you kind of reflecting on at this point in terms of running the business?
Well, I think the things to learn is, when we first started, we were given there was myself and another girl that started it, and then a few months later, another nurse came and joined us, so there was three of us. Mm-hmm. And we were offered and given it was free as well. We had a business consultant that would offer us support over a year to help us develop the business, which was wonderful. She was an amazing lady. Listen to her would have been my advice. A lot of the stuff she told us at the beginning we dismissed. She said right at the beginning, forget friendships. You've got to have strong contracts with each other. We'd all worked with each other for a number of years in different clinical settings. So we did dismiss that and think, no, we know each other. We'll be straight. You know, we can't see this being a problem. When money starts coming into people's lives, it does make a difference. But, you know, that. And it was really interesting how that can affect friendship groups, your friendship and as a group, how it changed. That was one thing. Also, I had this unrealistic expectation, I think, of everybody has to be equal as directors. And I think that took me a couple of years to realise that actually, no, you need a boss. You need that. I think I was trying to avoid having that hierarchical system, but actually you need someone to lead the business. Because I think it took me 2 to 3 years to stop thinking as a mental health nurse in the NHS, mm-hmm. and start thinking as a business person. I think it was a lot of it with my own mindset, I think, was the biggest things I learned. I'm trying to think what else I could really have learned. I think that was just the huge one, is just listening to the advice that we were given and setting up your structure. We were very good. I got a very good accountant and getting the books sorted. So the financial side was secure. Never upset the tax man, I think, is key. I think we were lucky in that sense. And I think, it's going back to contractory. Well, I'm very lucky with lots of people around us. So lots of people were very helpful and people give you lots of freebies. The problem is if you're running a business and someone does you a favour, you can't complain. So when we first started out, for example, we had a website, and it was a friend of a friend did it for us for free. It sounded great, but actually it wasn't quite what we wanted, and some of the setting up of it caused us problems later on. So I've sort of now felt, actually, you can give me mates rates, but we pay for a service so that we can chat. We need to have contracts for everything, and our structure of who's managing is much stronger. I think they're the key things we've learned. I'd say they were the main things.
And the plans that you have for next year, what are you thinking 10 years in?
Well, 10 years in, I mean, it's sort of like a bittersweet moment for us, really. Celebrating, you know, actually, we've been around for 10 years and all the, you know, thousands of families that have gone through the different parenting programs we're running, and a lot of success. We've been able to look back, and I've been so fortunate in the fact that I've been able to train in things like the Incredible Years Autism Program. We've developed, my colleague Debbie, who's the co-director, she's developed alongside our Flash program a new project for the teenagers, so we've got Teen Flash going. Lots of interesting projects, which I don't know if I stayed in the NHS, would I have had the opportunity to do. There are lots of achievements, and a really good success record with our parents. The sad bit is the funding of it all is coming to an end. And it's very quite sad when your own county don't really appreciate the work that's happening. But they have to make cuts, and they are cutting the parenting provision across Essex. This puts us in a real difficult situation, because a lot of the big grants now will only accept you if you have either a big turnover or if you're funded half to partially by a statutory organisation. So previously, because we had this grant funding, we were able to top it up with smaller grants. The problem with lots of little small grants, you can't secure your future, which means you can't secure staff posts because people have got mortgages to pay. Alongside that, the rent has gone up, and all costs, pensions, everything has, as I'm sure you're aware, all gone up. So we were deciding, you know, do we carry on with what we're doing and just cut our own wages, which, bear in mind, we haven't had a pay rise in 10 years. We were a bit reluctant to do because we've never had a pay rise. So we were contemplating, and then we thought, actually, let's see this as an opportunity. So Debbie and I felt, actually, there's lots of things on our wish list we haven't been able to get around to doing. There's some opportunities abroad. Because both Debbie and I did some work in India, and we'd like to come back. If you're running the business, can we do that? So in the end, we've decided we're going to take a sabbatical. And we're going to take at least a term out, not of trainings. We have got some trainings already pre-booked, but we're going to take a sabbatical out of running our regular groups. For the first time in 20 years, I haven't run a parenting group in a term. And we're going to stop and just take a bit of a seat back and just review the business plan, what we've learned, and we'd like to do some writing and then think about which is the way forward.
Yeah.
That's our plan.
And I think it's so important to hear these stories as well. It's not all, you know, kind of whatever, rainbows and unicorns in the world of running your own business, and these unexpected things that kind of suddenly appear, and having to adapt and go, right, well, this is not where we saw ourselves going, but it sounds really exciting, actually, the other opportunities that there are.
Yeah, the one thing that we agreed right in the beginning was I wasn't going to chase the money, I was going to chase the work. Because I've seen other organisations do this, that actually they change their mission statement, they change where they're at just so that they can keep going. And our expertise is in the parenting programs that we deliver. So I didn't want to, I mean, we've been asked to do other things, but actually I thought that's not our expertise. We're not, you know, we don't have our, maybe not, I don't feel that we're adequately trained to do that. I sort of almost want to keep us quite pure. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we'll be able to afford to do that in the long run. But I think before we carry on that treadmill of just doing the same thing, let's take a back. We looked at some of the changes. I mean, technology has been the biggest change, I think, in the last 10 years. For example, when we first started the business, you know, it would be 80% of our inquiries would be by phone and 20% email. Mm-hmm. Now it's completely the other way around. So you need social media much more, as you would know. So we need to focus much more on our social media. We had thought about, do we spend some time thinking about, people have asked us if we do like a parenting app and things like that. I have trialed by email a one-to-one program. I got funding once and we're supposed to be 12 parents and do parenting by email. We only had one parent that completed it, and actually she was a social worker and was doing it as part of her studies as well as for her own child, so she had more motivation. But the other parents all stopped doing it by email and asked to see face to face, which was quite interesting. Mm-hmm. And then in the Team Flash project, some of our funding we got was to actually promote the materials of our social media for the young people. So we thought these young people would be really into, you know, lots to do with social media, but the kids don't want that. They said they don't want to go online, they don't want to think, they actually want to talk to a human being and a person. So that we've had to rethink, so looking at other ways we can use social media, still keep that personal contact, all those sort of things we'd be looking at. Plus we've had some interest in China for our self-harm program.
Mm-hmm.
Off to China in April, which will be quite
very exciting.
And again, we're putting funding together, hopefully, for Debbie and I go back to India and to do some of the project work which we started. Well, she started it 2 years ago, and I did it last year.
Mm-hmm.
I was working in a school, with kids from very poor backgrounds, and it was a fantastic project to be involved in.
Mm. How did you get involved in that?
That was through my daughter. My daughter is a teacher, and in her last year at teacher training, mm-hmm. she went off and did some volunteer work. And actually, it's a school called Tender Heart in India, just outside Delhi. And she went and worked there, fell in love with the project, and she goes back every year. I spent four months last year there. So, Debbie, my co-facilitator, Doug Barnes, she went out a couple of years later, and I went out last year. It was an absolutely fascinating project. But we brought some of the resources that we have here to talk to the parents. What we didn't realise out there is that how much self-harm is really high.
Mm.
My own naivety, I didn't really know that. Yeah. So all our time there was actually talking to the parents and talking to teachers and thinking about actually what they were looking for and some of the resources that they were wanting. So it was the beginning of a quite an exciting partnership, I think, with Tender Heart. Great fun with the kids. They were just amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds really interesting as well. And when you know, perhaps the support's not there from within your own county and from the government to kind of go think differently in this new era we're in.
Yeah.
No, but I think this is a great approach. So, Jeannie, I was thinking, just to finish off, are there any sort of tips that you'd have for anyone who's thinking of perhaps taking their experience and wanting to start their own thing, just as you've done, where you felt that the training that you had was really, really important, and you knew the value of your work, but you wanted to kind of get it out there and not be lost. So any advice that you'd have for people who are thinking, you know, can I do this, or how should I get started?
I think for me, I think my biggest advice would be, because I often get people ringing up and think, oh, you know, they'd like to start up a parenting coaching business, etc. Culturally, we're not used to spending money on parenting. So, you might pay a solicitor a large amount of money because that's what culture you're expecting, or maybe not solicitor, but, if you went privately to see a doctor, you'd expect to pay. But actually coming to see somebody who's got behaviour problems with your child, that's culturally not quite the same. So I think there is a shift that needs to happen. So I would say if anybody's starting off, ensure that they've got another bit of income coming in. So do it part-time to start off with, and then build your reputation up, because majority of our referrals come through word by mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that makes a big difference, and it takes a while to get your reputation up. I think that would be a huge one. I think for me, prepared to be really, really doing an awful lot of hard work. And so I think having be at the right time. One of my colleagues who started up with us, and who I still miss every day, Melissa, one of the reasons that she left was she had younger children than I did. And I think we both underestimated how much time is spent, because it's not just delivering the programs, it's all the paperwork that goes alongside it. So 10 years on, we're very, sounds lovely, director of MOP, but actually at the end of the day, Debbie and I have got mops in our hands because we're still the cleaners. Yeah. So there's something about actually not as glamorous as everyone thinks. And keep grounded. And I think a lot of business consultants over the years have said to me that the non-profitable part of the business search is delivering the parenting groups. Delivering the trainings are more profitable. So they said to us, you know, just ditch the parenting groups. But actually, I think doing the parenting groups, that informs my trainings. Mm-hmm. And doing the trainings informs my parenting groups.
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, keep grounding. It's really important to, so that actually... I think you said about, you know, when I brought you, you felt that you felt the experience of the group through the training. And that's because every single week, you know, the parents are in my heart there, because I've just, like today, I've delivered a group this morning, we've got one to start this evening. So I can use their stories, their reflections, their learning. But also it helps you, I think, keep more current, so you can see what the patterns of, you know, new behaviours are, etc. But saying that, and I've made it sound like terrible setting up your own business, I absolutely love it. I absolutely love it. And it's so lovely to be able, because you're in control of it. I can deliver the programs how I really want to deliver them, not how I'm restricted to by other people's funding. So if I want to give extra time, okay, it's my time, but I can give it.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's, and the reason why I started this podcast is because people who are running their own business or their side projects, it's given them so much, and it's been transformative in their lives in so many positive ways. So
I think I was realistic at that at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of knew that this sort of work's never going to make you a millionaire. I sort of accepted that. I mean, you know, you still earn a wage from it. But I think when I compare myself to some of my nursing colleagues, they work just as hard as I do, long hours, etc. But when I compare them, I don't feel I have the same resentment sometimes that they have. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because running your own, you know, company enables you to have a little bit more freedom and a little bit more say in what you actually do and the direction it goes in. So I think I would still have funding issues, whether I was in the NHS, I would still have paperwork issues.
Yeah.
I can just troll them a little bit more. And that's what I like. I've got more choice in doing the stuff that I prefer to do.
Yeah. And really knowing the believing in the value of what you're doing.
And I think, I suppose, because of that, I've been able to choose people that to work around me that have the same values. Like Debbie, my co-director, very strong core values, same as me, really hardworking, and really good fun, as well as the other team members, Leslie and Anna. And I think because you can choose who your team is going to be around you, it provides a really nice working environment and atmosphere.
Jeannie, thank you so much for your time today. I really, really appreciate it. It was great to speak with you and just have a bit more of an insight into everything that you've done with Ministry of Parenting, and look forward to seeing what you do next.
Okay, thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
Thank you.
So there you have it, episode 17 with Jeannie Gordon of the Ministry of Parenting. I hope you're really enjoying these conversations and finding them really, really useful in terms of the insight you're getting from people who are running their own businesses. And if you'd like to discuss anything with me in the podcast further, you can drop me a line through Instagram. I'm at Marietta Sandylands, or via the Project Pod Facebook page. And you can also leave me a review, which would be wonderful, on Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you in a few weeks.